Super deal. Oh, I sound tall. That's a wonderful thing. There's a little church just south of Huntsville called Arab Church of Christ. It's in Arab, Alabama. It's not pronounced Arab. It's Arab, Alabama. And I was supposed to speak there one Sunday morning, and I was late. The idiot factor was high on the parkway. I go blazing into the building. The deacon in charge of the things that deacons are in charge of was standing in the back, and he was sweating bullets, and he handed me this little mic. Well, I just walk straight down the aisle and clip it on and look at it, and there's one button on it, and it says no. And I'm not about to turn the button to no. Things will blow up if you do that, you know. And then I realized that no is on upside down, so I turned it over and was okay. So it's probably not these guys' fault that I make the microphone mess up. It's mine. Anyway, Jackie started her season, and so she couldn't be with me. Lonnie Beth is wrapping up a job in Rome, Georgia. She graduated to college there and is the on-field personality for the Rome Braves. And she's doing a pretty good job. But she's moving home, working on her master's degree. And I suspect by this time next year, I might have a son-in-law if I'm not willing to hide a body somewhere. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. He's a fine young man, and so I probably won't be committing any crimes. My dog that I've talked about for years, Mulder, my big Rhodesian Ridgeback, he got real bad sick last year just before we went to our mission trip in the Honduras. And I knew we was going to leave town and be gone, you know, all of us. And I was cutting the grass, and Mulder would get out and follow me, and he'd fall down. That's how sick he was. And I'd try to cut the grass, and he'd fall down. I'd take him back, put him in his house. And so finally I just decided he wasn't going to make it. And so it's kind of a thing of honor. You know, you put a dog out of his misery. I didn't want a vet to do it. And so, you know, I put him down. I grew up in kind of around country people, and that's just what you do for your dogs. And it was humane, and he didn't know it was coming, and I didn't want him to be riding in a car, going to a vet, and be scared. So, you know, I put him down. This young man came to our house, and I walked him out in the backyard. I said, "You see that grave right there?" He said, "Yes, sir." I said, "That's my dog." I said, "I had that dog 15 years. I love that dog. I put a bullet in him. I've known you about 6 months." And so we're on the same page anyway, as it goes. I'm happy to be with you. Have enjoyed reacquainting myself with Casey. We have borrowed Beth Pittman. She married one of our guys, Michael Rosenblum, and she's a member at our congregation and an asset to us. She and Michael as well, and so I'm glad to know some of those folks. Brother Jenkins was up our way holding a gospel meeting and got to hear him and get to be friends with him. I want to do something real simple tonight, and it's going to take me a long time to get to the point I want to make, but if we don't do a lot of details, it won't be the same point. You know, there's just some things you can't tell somebody how a movie ends unless you've seen all the movies. If you saw the last Star Wars, the real last one, not the third last one that was in the middle that was before the other. If you saw the last one and didn't know the backstory, it didn't make any. So when we get to this point, it has to have a backstory. And this is a story all of you know. All of you could tell it. All of you are familiar with it. But I've got to walk you through this process, because until I was walked through the process, I didn't get it. First thing is, I need to ask you a question about evangelism. Have you ever felt inadequate about your attempts to evangelize? Okay, in Alabama, this means yes, and this means no, and this means you're not voting. Okay, you ever felt inadequate about your attempts to evangelize? You know, I'm just a kid, or I'm just a parent. I'm not one of those guys that can lead singing. I'm not one of those guys who can preach like Brother Jenkins. And we start talking about things that we do for God, and it seems like that the way we've often heard it defined and the way I'm really comfortable doing it doesn't always match up. Am I the only person to ever struggle with that? You know, I believe in the value of door knocking. I do. I've been on door knocking campaigns, but I'm just not very good at it. I mean, how would you like to open your door and find me standing on your porch? Right? I understand what we're dealing with here, okay? And then add to it that we only door knock in the summertime. And in Alabama, it's 111 degrees in the shade with 100% humidity, and we don't have a sea breeze. So it's hot. Okay, you stand there and make your own gravy. So I go up and knock on somebody's door. They look out that little hole. I'm 5'4". They don't see anybody. So I knock it down here, you know. And then it's like there's a criminal. There's, you know, a guy from the UFC standing on my porch, you know. And he's pouring water off of his little bald head. Nobody's going to. And I know what my voice sounds like. You notice they don't ask me to lead singing. They ask me to preach. They ask me to preach to keep me from leading singing. I mean, that's just the bottom line. I understand that. So although I do it and although I've done it, I've never been very successful at it. Not good at it. And so I want us to think about what it is you're good at and why you're good at it and how to use it for evangelism. If you have your Bibles, turn them to 1 Samuel 17. I read this story to you from the New King James Version. And like I say, this is a story you all know, but keep your radar up and try to stay with me. Now the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle, and they were gathered at Socah, which belongs to Judah. And they encamped between Socah and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they encamped the Valley of Elah. And they drew up in a battle array against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side with a valley between them. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head. He was armed with a coat of mail. The weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. He had a bronze armor on his legs, a bronze javelin between his shoulders. Now the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels. And a shield bearer went before him. And he stood, and he cried out to the armies of Israel, and he said to them, "Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and you servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves, and let him come down to me. And if he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." And when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed, greatly afraid. What you have here is a typical Old Testament warfare scenario. And Old Testament warfare and modern warfare are incredibly different. Now, we live in a town, Huntsville, Alabama, with mechanical engineers. A lot of the mechanical engineers are employed by the Defense Department. To one of the guys that goes to church with us, says design exotic toys. His clientele that he works with live on military compounds. They have long hair. They have beards. They wear no insignia on their sleeves. They get dropped in country, behind enemy lines, in small groups, and they do serious stuff. Steve, the guy who designs some of these things, says, if we assign an asset to you, that means if we point something at you, what goes boom. If we assign an asset to you, with the exception of mechanical failure, you are dead. We're killing people we never even see. There's some boys that live in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Last names are Barrett. They designed and developed a 50 caliber long-range sniper rifle. The longest recorded shot with that rifle on a human-sized target has been over a mile and a half. It used to be a mile and a half. A Canadian made the shot. Just recently, one of the American boys made a shot on a human target past a mile and a half. I volunteer, not a cop, not an operator. I just volunteer as a chaplain, and I've been assigned to our local SWAT team for 19 years. We have night vision goggles and a SIMRAD scope. Night vision takes ambient light and amplifies it so you can see in the dark. The SIMRAD scope doesn't have to have ambient light. It sees body heat. So I can turn it on and start looking through a tree line, and 98.6 degrees is the human body. You'll glow red on that target finder. I can see that body heat through a wall. I can see that body heat through a car. We tried out some material one time. You wear this goofy little headset with an eyepiece, and you wear a chest plate, and the chest plate works like a tapping board on a laptop computer. And you tap that thing, and it gives you a satellite view in this eyepiece looking down on you, and everybody who's wearing a chest piece shows green. Everything walking around you that's not wearing a chest piece is red. So I know exactly where all my people are, and I know exactly where all the bad guys are. I can hit a couple of buttons, and I can see through my eyepiece what you're seeing from your eyepiece. So I could stand here at the front of the building, and if you're standing at the back of the building, we could swap information, and I could be looking at the back of your heads from up here, which is just kind of cool. It makes my head swim a little bit when I do it. All kind of modern stuff going on. That's not what it was in Old Testament warfare. Old Testament warfare, you get an army on this hill and an army on this hill. They began to shout slogans at one another. They would praise their God or curse you. Your mother wears army sandals or, you know, whatever. You'd have guys in lines with intermediate weapons and short-range weapons. Then you'd occasionally have a guy with a real long pole with a banner on it. And I know we've all sung Sound the Battle Cry, Raise the Standard High, His Banner Over Us is Love, all kind of songs with banners. The idea behind a banner is you got this long pole and it's got a symbol on it. Each of the 12 tribes of Israel had an animal symbol. You didn't have a uniform. You didn't have a jersey. You know, you didn't have a uniform with the Star of David and your name on the back. You were just dressed like you were dressed to go out to battle with armor, and the armor might not be distinct. So you go down here in this field, and you're fighting people. And you're fighting people what the Japanese call the distance required for touching. I'm not shooting you at 150 yards. I'm not shooting you at a mile away. I'm not sending a missile out from space. I've got to run up to you and put my eyes on you and fight you. And if I look over my shoulder and I see a banner and it's got my symbol on it, I fight my way to that banner and I know my people are there and you know your people are there, and that way you don't get out there and get outnumbered and surrounded by people who aren't yours. So you basically would fight in groups kind of defending this one area or this one banner. If you want to get a good idea of what it would be to be in an Old Testament warfare, go to Walmart and... That's not the part you're supposed to... Go to Walmart and buy a $7 machete. That machete has better steel in it than their swords would have had in it. And you go find you a pine tree that a storm has blown over that's got dead limbs on it. You take that machete and you start at one end and you hack your way to the other end walking up that pine tree. And the first time you miss a lick, the first time you don't sever that limb, and the first time that machete slips in your hand, you just died in Old Testament combat. Those guys got down there and they fought hand to hand with primitive, crude weapons. And it was a meat grinder. So on this day, you've got Israel on this hill. You've got the Philistines on this hill. Everybody's lined up. Their battle's in array. And just as they start to march down the hill, one guy breaks ranks and walks out to the middle of the hillside. And he says, "Aren't you servants of Saul?" And he's yelling, "Am I not a Philistine?" Well, instead of everybody fighting, just pick one guy. Just send one guy down here and we'll fight. And if he kills me, you win. And if I kill him, we win. He's going to make this challenge 80 times. He'll do it every morning and every evening for 40 days. And nobody in Israel will make a move. He gives an unanswered challenge 80 times. The problem with this guy is the description of him. First, the Bible describes him as being 6 cubits and a span. A cubit is the distance from the bend of your elbow to the tip of your middle finger. And a span is the distance from the tip of your thumb to the tip of your little finger. And two spans always equal a cubit. Now, the king of Israel is Saul. Saul is head and shoulders above everybody in Israel. So we're thinking you might get a little more money for your cubit, because a lot of times these body length measurements were based off the royalty or off the king. So somewhere in the neighborhood, Goliath is 6 cubits and a span. Best guess is a cubit could be 18 to 21 inches. So 18 inches at 6.5 of those would put the shortest Goliath could have been about 9 feet tall. Now, if you want to get a good picture of 9 feet, you're sitting in your high school gymnasium and they introduce this rascal. And he walks out of the locker room, walks behind your backboard, squats down and stands up under the rim. His face is in the net. That's Goliath at 9 feet tall. If a cubit is 21 inches, he's 11 feet tall. You're sitting in your high school gymnasium. They introduce Goliath from Gath. He walks out of the locker room, ducks under the backboard, and tries to stand up under the rim, but his shoulders catch on the rim. He can't get straight up because his shoulders would hook the rim. That's the guy standing here making this challenge. He's wearing a coat, and it's either overlapping plates of armor or intersecting circles of armor. And it says it weighs 5,000 shekels of bronze. That's basically about 125 pounds. This guy's walking down a hill ready to fight with Justin Bieber on his shoulders, all right? I mean, that's basically what he's going into battle with, all right? So there he is. Now, he's got bronze thigh pads, just like a football player would wear, but instead of it being that soft neoprene rubber, it's metal on his thighs. He's got a bronze target, either a plate on his back so you can't snipe him from behind, or he's got a backup javelin made of bronze on his shoulders. And he's carrying a spear, the shaft of which is like a weaver's beam, which means it's not your typical ordinary broom handle size shaft. It's bigger, and on the end of it is an iron spear point that weighs as much as a shot put does in track and field for boys high school. Now, if you want to understand the strength of this man, sometime when you've got nothing else to do and you're prowling around Walmart, get a 12 to 16 pound sledgehammer. Hold that hammer by the handle just at the end with the business end pointing up. Stick your hand straight out. And then bend your wrist till you bring the hammer down to your nose. Give it a little kiss and lift it back up. If you've just got new braces, don't do this. And if you're not pressing around 200 on the bench press, don't do it at all. Or wear a football helmet. Now, this guy's not holding a sledgehammer. He's holding a spear that's got leverage on both ends, this shot put sharpened on this end, and he can use it to thrust with, he can use it to overhand with, and he can throw it. That's understanding the size of this guy's wrist and the size of this guy's hands and the muscles that are wrapped in him. And he's standing out here with a guy with a shield before him, and he's saying, I dare you, I challenge you, I defy you. Send somebody to fight me. And nobody touches it. And then the scene changes. You've got this going on in the Valley of Elah, and literally, meanwhile, back at the ranch comes up. 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 12. Now David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse. He had 8 sons. The man was old and advanced in years in the days of Saul, and the 3 oldest sons of Jesse had gone to follow Saul to the battle. The names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, Abinadab, and the 3rd, Shemaiah. David was the youngest, and the 3 oldest followed Saul. Now, occasionally, David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. And the Philistine drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. Now Jesse said to his son David, take now for your brothers an ephah of this dried grain and these 10 loaves and run to your brothers at the camp. And carry these 10 cheeses to your captain of their thousands and see how your brothers fare and bring back news to me. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the Valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. So David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with the keeper, and took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the camp as the army was going out to fight, shouting for the battle. What's the worst summer job you've ever had? You ever had a bad summer job? I had a job in Montgomery, Alabama one time, walking through the forest spraying for insecticides and herbicides. They put this huge tank on your back, filled it with poison, said take a step and go pss, 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 and take another step and go pss, 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 pss. And you do that till you run out of tank. And then you walk back. And by the way, don't eat anything or touch anything if the stuff that goes is on your hands. And so you're sweating, you start to wipe your brow, and you think, oh no, I'm going to contaminate myself and make my hair fall out and stunt my growth. Okay, maybe that's not what I... I'm about to hurt my feelings, what y'all are about to do. Anyway, what's the... David is a sheep keeper. Now let me tell you something about keeping sheep. Sheep are probably the dumbest animals on the planet. Everything that eats, eats sheep. Sheep are meals on wheels in the animal kingdom. From a shepherd, a bird of prey can land on a sheep's head and peck his eyes out, and the sheep can do nothing about it. Read Psalm 23. You know who wrote it? David. You know who wrote a lot of the Psalms? David. You know why? He kept sheep, had a lot of time on his hands. Out there in the wilderness, fooling with these dumb sheep. He leads me to green pastures, makes me lie down in green pastures. Why? A sheep eats the grass, roots and all. So you've either got to graze the sheep close, and the next day take them further, and the next day further, or you've got to take them way, way out and graze your way back in. He leads me beside still water. Sheep won't drink out of a stream that's making too much noise. They're paranoid because everything that eats, eats sheep. My cup runneth over. Sheep won't stick his head in the bucket. They're paranoid. And you're really not paranoid if they're really out to get you, okay? And so the sheep won't stick his head in the bucket, so the bucket has to run over. You anoint my head with oil. A sheep will stand out in the field and graze till he dies of a heat stroke if you don't walk by and cool him off a little bit. Literally, a sheep will walk off the edge of a cliff grazing. I used to roof houses with a guy who'd walk off the roof about once a month. He'd pop a chalk line and step right off. His name was Stanley. Stanley the roofer. Not a very bright young man. But he would go roof diving just about once a month. He'd forget where he was. Well, sheep will do it all the time. So here you've got a teenage boy, and his summer job is keeping these sheep. Now, do you remember watching those old black and white movies with your parents about people who drove sheep across the American West? No, you don't, because they don't make movies about sheep herders. It's boring. Stampede! Bah. I mean, that's it. There's no excitement, nothing going on with these guys. You're a teenage boy growing up in Israel, and your summer job is, I'm going to keep these stupid sheep. And they're a hassle. You got to lead them to water. You got to lead them to green. You got to anoint their heads. They get lost. They walk off cliffs. You got to make sure nothing eats them. And I mean, it's just, wow. So his dad says, hey, tomorrow, how'd you like to go see the army? Visit the army, keep the sheep. No brainer. Did you hear what the Bible says? And early the next day, teenage boy gets up crack of dawn, something's going on important. Okay, right? He gets up early, leaves the sheep with the keeper, and not only is he going to go to see his brothers, he's going to get to take food to the captains of the thousand. He's going to get to meet the brass. He can get to meet the captain, the lieutenant, and the sergeant major, light colonel. He can get to meet all these guys that are important in the army. So not only does he go get to see his big brothers and get to see the army, which is seriously cool, he gets to go see the brass. As he gets there, the Bible says when he arrived, the army is marshaling itself for war. So he leaves the supplies with the keeper and he joins his brothers. So here's young David walking with the army as they're about to go to battle. Now, if you're a kid and you grew up in Israel, how exciting is it to watch God's army go into battle? You know the stories you grew up on? Hey, God's army marches around this building. They blow a trumpet and the thing falls down. Hey, God's army goes to battle and God will hold the sun in the air so they can fight longer. God's army goes to battle and Moses raises his hands, they win. Moses puts his arms down, they lose. Moses invented the wave. I mean, this is cool stuff. You take God's army and you send them in the battle outnumbered 400-1 and you arm them with lanterns and pitchers and torches and trumpets and they defeat an army that outnumbers them at least 400-1, and that's only counting the survivors of that army. That's not the actual numbers. Hey, if you're a kid in Israel and you're about to get to see the army of God go into battle, you're expecting big stuff. And so here he is, he joins the, and he's walking with his brothers, and they're going out to battle. They've got their armor, and they're shouting, and they're getting ready to do their thing. 1 Samuel chapter 17. Starting in Start back at verse 20. So David rose up early in the morning, left the sheep with the keeper, and he took his things, and he went as Jesse had commanded him, and he came to the camp, and the army was going out to fight and shouting for battle, and for Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army, and David left his supplies in the hand of the keeper and ran to the army and greeted his brothers, and as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines, and he spoke according to the same words, and David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. It shall be the man who kills him. The king will enrich with great riches and will give him his daughter and give him his father's house exemption from tax in Israel." And David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, "What shall be done to the man who kills the Philistine and who takes away the approach from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him and said in this manner, "So shall it be done for the man who kills him." Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger was aroused against David, and he said, "Why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you came down here to see the battle." And David said, "What have I done now? Is there not a cause?" David's walking with his brothers, talking about the battle. "Are you guys shouting? Are you guys going to fight? This is..." And then all of a sudden, this guy steps out. He starts talking, and everybody goes the other way. And I read from the context that they're either explaining to David why they ran, or David's asking him why they ran. And their answer is, "Have you seen this man? Surely he's come up to defy Israel." And so David's talking to these guys, and then they finally say, "And if somebody goes down there and kills him, he'll be rich, he'll get to marry the king's daughter, and his family will be tax exempt." Now, which one of those things you think caught David's attention? Taxes, smaxes, money, funny. That king's daughter got David's attention. You show me a girl in the Bible David met he didn't marry. That's all I'm saying. David was a chick magnet, all right? I'm telling you right now. So he's like, whoa, now what? Go over that again? If I go down there, because this is just an uncircumcised guy and he's defying. Now, if I kill him, what? And then his oldest brother hears him. Look what his older brother says to him. "What's wrong with you? What are you doing here? You're not a soldier. You're a sheep keeper. And not only are you a sheep keeper, you're not a very important sheep keeper. Where have you left those few sheep in the wilderness?" And you don't even really have a good place to keep your sheep. It's the wilderness. He is insulting his little brother. He's embarrassed that his little brother is talking about doing something that he would. I think that he's embarrassed. My rock climbing partner thinks he's scared. Because see, if your little brother goes down into the valley to fight the giant and he gets in the deep end of the pool without his floaties on, who has to bail him out? Troy says, "Look, if you go down there and start something, I got to come down there and finish it up for you." I'm going to try to do everything I can to keep you from biting off more than you can chew. For whatever reason, his brother is in. David said, "What's going to happen? I get to marry who? And what's wrong with you? Well, you punk. You stupid little sheep keeper. All you do is keep, and you don't keep very many sheep, and you're not very responsible. Who'd you leave those sheep with? You arrogant, insolent, prideful kid." Now, if I tell you how this story ends, is it going to ruin it for anybody? If we fast forward, is that going to bother anybody? Because I want to make the point, David is not arrogant. David is not prideful. And David is not insolent. You go to the end of this story, and there's an interesting exchange that happens. 1 Samuel 17, verse 55. When Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I do not know." So the king said, "Inquire whose son this young man is." Then, as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered and said, "I am the son of your servant Jesse the Bethlehemite." When my wife won her 200th volleyball game, she'd been a coach 7 years, won the city championship 5 out of those 7 years, done a three-peat 3 years in a row. Nobody's ever done it in the history of Huntsville. When she won her 200th volleyball game, they gave her a volleyball, and everybody in the gym signed it. You ever been given a game ball? I got a dead deer head on my garage wall. I sat in a tree and bushwhacked him with a bow. David has just walked up the hill and into the tent of the king carrying the head of a giant he just killed. Folks, this is the game ball. National championship trophy. He is the national hero. He's done something nobody else in Israel was willing even to attempt, and he's just done it, and done it in great fashion. And he walks into the tent of the king who's too much of a coward to go down and fight this guy, and the king says, "Whose son are you?" And if it had been me, I said, "Son, nothing. I'm your daddy. That's who I am." But David doesn't do that. David's brother accuses him of being arrogant and prideful. And listen, David's standing here holding the head of the giant. "Whose son are you?" "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." He doesn't even say, "I'm your number one servant." He said, "Sir, my daddy's your servant, and therefore I'm your servant." Folks, there's not an arrogant bone in this kid's body. This young man has a character and a respect and a demeanor that most of us don't even understand. So his brother says, you arrogant, insolent, and he's not. So David begins to inquire further, and I'm going to run out of time, so I'm going to have to just go without reading. Basically, they tell Saul, "Hey, we found a guy that's applied for the job to kill the giant." Saul says, "I need to interview him." So he comes in. He said, "Young man, I understand you've applied for the job of killing our giant. What's your resume?" "I'm a shepherd." "Does that bother anybody but me? Let me review the job qualifications. You have to kill a giant. I didn't ask you if you could lead him into his pen. This is kill a giant." David said, "Sir, as a shepherd, everything that eats sheep. And a lion took one of my sheep, and I followed it, and I took the sheep from its mouth. It turned against me, and I grabbed it by its beard and smote it." Now, this may be the long chin whiskers of a northern Asian lion, or it could be the full mane of a big lion, and he grabbed him by his beard. Now, we read that, and we read that, and we go, "Yeah, he killed a lion." Let me see if I can put this in perspective for you. I hunt deer, and I hunt deer with a bow. And my bow is not a primitive weapon. My bow is 26 and a half inches from axle to axle. It pulls 70 pounds. When I turn it loose, it will throw an arrow 300 feet a second. That means in the time it takes your clock to go tick, it'll go from goalpost to goalpost on your football field. You don't shoot at a deer any further than about 40 yards, and 40 yards is kind of showing off. So within about 30 yards, you get a deer coming in on you, and you draw that bow up, and you release that arrow. If a deer hears that arrow make a whistle, if there's a chip in that feather and it hums as it goes, if my string pops, if my stand creaks, that deer, they call it jumping the string, can literally lay down and dodge that arrow, make the stuff on the matrix look like a cheap trick. You got an arrow moving 300 feet a second, and that deer can dodge it inside of 30 yards, closer than we play dodgeball. A lion comes from the factory with the tools and the speed and the strength to catch and kill a deer. Can you even do the math there? Folks, you take a mixed martial arts fighter and you put him against a lion, and he looks like that scene in Spider-Man where they slow everything down. Okay? A mountain lion, one of our lions that lives around here, a little Florida panther, from a sitting still position can jump 17 or 18 vertical feet. From a sitting down position can leap horizontally 23 feet. And this young man said, "I took a sheep away from it, it turned on me, and I killed it." Because everything that eats sheep, and sometimes you have to do business. So Saul says, "Tell you what, you can have the job. By the way, I killed a bear too. You can have the job, here's my armor." Now Saul's either a fool or the smartest political guy in the world. First of all, Saul's head and shoulders above everybody in Israel, so either David's a big guy and can fit Saul's armor, or Saul understands that if my armor goes out and fights the giant and comes back, guess who everybody thinks killed the giant? It's not like you're on Facebook or Twitter heading to kill giant today. You know, no. Hey, I saw Saul's armor go down there. I saw Saul's armor come back. Amazing. Saul, you know, and if he goes down there and his armor gets killed and then he's still alive, then that just makes him a legend. So Saul's not an idiot. He's trying to get David to wear it. David said, I hadn't proved this stuff. So David goes down into the valley, and you know what he takes with him? A stick, a bag, 5 rocks, and a sling. You know what those are? Shepherd's tools. Guys, do you see a pattern here? Now, David goes down there, and as he's walking down the hill, they trash talk. The giant says, what am I, a dog, that you'd send a kid down here with a stick to run me off? Come down here. I'm going to feed you to the birds. David says, you come to me with a sword and with a shield and with a spear, but I come to you in the name of the Lord God of the armies of Israel. And the Lord does not save with a sword or with a shield, but the battle is the Lord's, and He'll give you to my hands, and I'll take your head from you and feed you and your friends to the birds. And then David starts running toward him, puts his hand in that bag, loads that sling, slings it once. Man, that thing ends quicker than an Indiana Jones movie. It's done. Goliath is dead. And it's over. And we all know he killed the giant, but I want you to understand, when he applied for the job to kill the giant, what did he say? I'm a shepherd. When he got the chance to go kill the giant, what did he take with him? His shepherd's tools. Now listen to this verse. We'll go over to Psalm 78. And this is the verse when I first had it discovered. It scared me a little because I thought maybe I had been wrong on some things. Psalm chapter 78 is a great review of Israel's history, and then it kind of fast forward. Verse 70 of Psalm 78. Mark this in your Bible. Bend the page down, outline it, underscore it, whatever you have to do. And he also chose David his servant, and he took him from the sheepfolds, from following the ewes that had young, and brought him to shepherd Jacob his people and Israel his inheritance. And he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them by the skillfulness of his hands. You guys know the difference between noun and verb? We read in Psalm 7, in 1 Samuel 17, that David is a shepherd. What is David doing in Psalm 78? Shepherding. He goes from the noun to the verb. Folks, God did not take a little shepherd boy and turn him into a king. God took a fella who was shepherding sheep with skill and integrity and allowed him to shepherd a nation. God didn't change a shepherd into a king. He took a guy that was a good shepherd and said, would you shepherd my nation? Interestingly enough, when you read in 2 Samuel 24, David numbers the people. God's angry with this. God sends a plague on Israel. David sees an angel standing over Jerusalem ready to destroy it. David intervenes between an angel and Israel. And do you know what David says to the angel? Let these sheep be. He saw them as his sheep. Because all he ever was a shepherd. But he went from shepherding in the wilderness to shepherding from Jerusalem. Because he behaved with skill and integrity. Now, you know what God's looking at for you? He's looking at how well you handle math class. He's looking at how well you handle football practice. He's looking at what kind of cheerleader you are. He's looking at what kind of artist or what kind of musician, what kind of soccer player, what kind of little league coach, what kind of housewife, what kind of neighbor, what kind of grocery bagger, what kind of paper delivery boy you are. And God says, if you'll take who you are with the experience I've given you and the tools I provided for you, and you'll just use those things with skill and integrity, I'll put you in a place where those things become really, really, really important. And if you've been thinking that your mission field is to leave and go to some exotic place like Nevis or Guadalupe or South Africa, and there's a need for us to go on mission trips. But folks, your real mission field is where you're at. It's your sheepfold. It's your high school. It's your team. It's your neighborhood. It's where you buy your groceries. It's where you pump your gas. It's those six or seven houses you jog by every day. It's those kids you babysit. It's those little bitty guys who look up to you because you're a varsity player. And how you use the little stuff right now will determine on what God does about giving you responsibilities that are bigger. He's not going to fundamentally change you. David never changed from anything but a shepherd. But he went from shepherding sheep to shepherding a nation. And so we're going to be evangelists. We're going to have to learn what it is to be good stewards of the opportunities and the talents and the tools that God has given us. And it's all about learning to have skill in our hands and integrity in our hearts. If I ask one of you for a dollar and said, I want to show a demonstration with it, would somebody give me a dollar? Now, I'm not going to take it because you're not going to get it back. But let's assume for illustration purposes, this young man gives me a dollar and I rip it up. And I go, can I get five? What would you do then? No, why? Because I saw what you did with the one. You make a judgment that says if he'll handle a dollar that way, I'm not going to trust him with the five. Well, God's looking at what you're doing with what you're doing with the dollars he gives you as a kid to decide where he places you as an adult. And if you do your athletics or your academics or your gymnastics or your music or your art or whatever it is that you do, and you do it with God first, God will use that as a venue to help you be the person God wants you to be. God didn't change a shepherd into a king. God just took a shepherd and let him shepherd people. And if we're going to start out a weekend talking about evangelism, we're going to have to understand that evangelism starts right where you are. Your youth group, your home, your school, your community. And it may be the worst job. You may not like where you're at. You may not like who you're at. You may not like what you look like. You may not like anything about it. But God's got you in that sheepfold. And God says, let me see how you handle that. And all of a sudden you'll understand that the things you learn from keeping sheep, you can use to kill giants. And if you use the things you learn from keeping sheep to kill giants, God will give you a kingdom. And it's not about whether God can do it or not. It's whether or not you'll allow it to be done by behaving with skill and integrity. What sheepfold are you in? And are you giving your life to God and doing it with skill and integrity? That's where evangelism starts. And that's why we're not good at it, because we leave our sheepfold and try to do something we're not suited for. We're walking around wearing Saul's armor. Where you're at is where you're supposed to be. What are you doing with it? Let's pray.